Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser. Tonight, we are talking about a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and that is video game preservation and some of the recent debates and comments that have been brought up about it lately. Over the last few weeks, the EFF, or Electronic Frontier Foundation, wanted to file an exemption regarding the Digital Media Copyright Act, or DMCA, which was designed to prevent software piracy and people from modding and basically playing games and other software for free. Their objective was to file an exemption to allow people to basically mod games so they don't need to access online servers in an attempt to preserve them, because as we know, many video games are no longer playable due to online server authentication, which we'll talk about more later in this cast. But the issue was countered by the Entertainment Software Association, or the ESA, claiming that this would promote piracy, and of course, piracy is bad. So I reached out to the EFF to talk to them about this issue and to interview someone, and they were kind enough to introduce me to my guest tonight. Please welcome to the podcast. She is a law student at Harvard, and she co-filed the exemption with the EFF. Please welcome Kendra Albert.
Hi, Josh. Glad to be here.
Hi, Kendra. It's a pleasure to have you on today. So to get things started, now my audience is mainly students, enthusiasts, and game developers. And one of the weird elements of the video game industry is how there's a lot of unknowns about some of the corporate or the managerial side of things, especially with some of the major organizations out there. To get things rolling, Kendra, could you talk a little bit about what the EFF is and what your role was with filing this exemption?
Sure. So the EFF, or the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is an organization that fights for your rights and your liberties online. Mm-hmm. And they do that through a number of different sort of channels. They have do some really important civil liberties work, including fighting like domestic surveillance and the NSA. But they also work on intellectual property issues that affect people online, including copyright and paracopyright, which is what the DMCA 1201 is about. I ended up working with the EFF because I was an intern there last summer. Mm-hmm. And when interning there, my boss turned to me one day and he said, "Hey, so there's this exemption proceeding coming up. We're going to need you to do some background. And also, I have a list of potential issues that you might want to take a look at and see if there's anything sort of any there in terms of communities that we that are sort of being, there's a chilling effect from the DMCA." Okay. I've actually been playing video games for, many, many years. I'm a pretty avid gamer. And so when I saw multiplayer servers and authentication servers for video games on the list, I was really psyched to get to work on this issue. Mm-hmm. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there have actually been a number of archivists and preservationists and video game enthusiasts who've been sort of, who've been producing information suggesting that this is a real problem for the future and of video games and the history of video games. And this hadn't been something that would have been on my radar. So I, at the end of the summer, had actually convinced the EFF to file this exemption with me, or they had allowed me to co-file it with them, whichever version, whichever version sounds better. Mm-hmm. So both because we think it's really important to remove the chilling effects of DMCA 1201, mm-hmm. but also because we wanted to raise the attention surrounding this issue and sort of bring it to the forefront because, you know, although I, you know, avidly read the Preserving Virtual Worlds report, many gamers aren't necessarily super involved in the scholarly or preservation communities and mm-hmm. may not know that the games that they love to play now may not be accessible to them in 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, and that's something that I am very strongly about here at Game Wisdom, because I approach things from a very analytical, very scholarly point of view. And I grew up playing video games. I mean, I'm right with you with pretty much the last, oh my god, I can't even count how many years anymore involved playing video games. And there is definitely a huge issue with video game preservation all around, which I will talk about in a few minutes, but I do want to focus more on this specific issue with online server authentication, because I know it from a game player point of view. I do want to get your thoughts on some of the research and findings you found while you were conducting your interviews regarding it. From my point of view, and from the point of view of gamers, server authentication really took hold over the last decade. And this was a way for publishers to control essentially who could play a game or not. The game required either a connection to the online server, or it required critical patches to be downloaded, which you could only get by accessing the game online. Not only that, but many online and multiplayer games had major modes and functionality that required server authentication to the game developer or the game publisher's specific servers. They didn't have LAN or direct IP access. So what happened is when a developer or publisher decides to take those servers down, whether it's due to cost, they just don't want to deal with it anymore, or the game is dead, anyone who still wants to play those games are effectively screwed. Because without having access to the server, they can't connect to other players, they can't download the necessary patches. And from anyone who's listened to this cast before knows how much we, quote-unquote, love EA and Origin, and their constant use of server authentication with many of their games, and it's almost become like an annual thing to see what games are going to take off and basically screw the consumer out of. With my little introduction done, from your point of view, Kendra, and the research that you've done, how is this affecting developers and preservationists?
So there's a number of different ways in which this particular issue affects preservation. And I think one of them is that the thing you've kind of touched on, which is actually a lot of overlap with the issue with gamers, which is these communities that are enabled by the like access to multiplayer servers, where I can play with someone on, you know, on the West Coast or on, you know, in Europe. When the servers are eliminated, the community disappears, and that it can be really difficult to understand even like really formative early online games when the server sort of like disappeared and the community splintered. And so one of the folks who filed testimony in our exemption is a sociologist at MIT named T.L. Taylor, and she studies and has studied how folks interact with games, and how she there's certain sort of behaviors that come out in multiplayer that are kind of games are generative. So this idea, there's this idea here that, you know, the developer may not even know what could be possible in a video game. And we're not just talking like Second Life or sort of these games that are meant to be really spaces where players are really creative. But even sort of games that are more traditional, like Call of Duty or, you know, something like a sports game, there can be sort of these player behaviors that just sort of spring up organically that get eliminated when servers get shut down. The really terrible thing about this, in addition to the community, is that often communities are organized around these corporate spaces. So, for example, I think it was actually 2K, when they shut down one of their NBA games, they just like basically eliminated all trace that it had ever existed, right? Like they just got rid of the forums in addition to getting rid of the game. So not only can you not play this game online anymore, this game that you might have been felt really passionately about, but there's like no record of it having existed. You can't even complain on the forums or start a petition because the people who you would talk to don't, like, there's no connection there anymore. So that's, I think, a really powerful way in which there's sort of an overlap between the concerns of like enthusiasts and the concerns of preservationists. To get a little more into the weeds on the preservation side, so if you're we had some folks from the Internet Archive, we had some folks from the Museum of Arts and Digital Entertainment talk about what they need to do in order to save these games and make sure that they're playable for the next generation. Because often there is a debate within games archiving about the sort of necessity of playability, but I think most archivists and most preservationists come down on the side that to really understand these games, to really have them be something that we can pass on and to generations, they're going to need to be playable. And, you know, the sort of alternatives, which are kind of like video footage, don't really sort of satisfy that same need. So what you need is to be able to eliminate the kind of server call that you're talking about with like EA or Origin in order to allow the game to be played. And that's exactly the sort of thing that DMCA 1201 sort of has a chilling effect upon. It's of a questionable legality. And the thing about DMCA 1201 is that I think it's fair to say that no one really saw the possible extent to which this law has affected all kinds of industries. One of the other petitions the EFF filed is actually on behalf of the owners of tractors. And this is the same law, right, that's inhibiting them from repairing their tractors because companies like John Deere have suggested that the software on the tractor constitutes a copyrighted work that's protected by technological protection mechanisms, just the same as video games. And that, you know, accessing this without sort of going through their process is circumventing it within the realm of the statute. So I think what this the process and the exemptions have suggested is that the reach of the statute has far exceeded any original concerns about sort of a relatively small group of copyrighted works. And that it's really affecting all kinds of areas that are sort of were never expected. The other one that's really striking is that there's folks who want to reverse engineer and check the security on pacemakers. And that's actually also possibly a DMCA 1201 violation. So there's, you know, this isn't just about video gamers, although the sort of preservation concerns are really immediate because often, you know, the, like there are so many video games released every year. There are so many video games taken offline every year and being able to sort of step in as that's happening and save a copy for like later generations and, you know, eliminate the access controls while you're sort of still in the mode of like, this is a game worth saving is really, really important.
Yeah, definitely. And you touch on a lot of great points there, Kendra. I'm not quite sure where to start on because you hit so many great points I wanted to talk about. Let me start with actually what you said regarding when the original DMCA was enacted, and you said 2001?
No, sorry, I didn't mention a year. But I think it's I'm blinking on the year. It's a little embarrassing, but probably the late 90s.
Okay. And that's a really good point. That's something that we're seeing not just with game preservation, but piracy, Let's Plays, virtual ownership, the whole deal. And part of the problem that's, I'm not sure this would be unique to the video game industry or not, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the things about the video game industry is that the last decade was such a huge forward momentum in digital infrastructures, digital distribution, game design. I mean, it's just a fundamental shift from the 90s to the 2000s to our decade. And what happened is that we've really overstepped or we've gone so far ahead of what the legal side of digital ownership is, what it means to own a game, that a lot of the lawmakers and even like Supreme Court are still trying to catch up with us. And this presents a very tricky thing because right now, pretty much all these rules and laws are decided by the game makers and the game publishers. And they most often don't have the consumer or the preservationists in mind when they're making these decisions.
Yeah, definitely. There's actually a really amazing book that I'll recommend to you and also to your listeners called Best Before, where the author takes on, I think it's James Newman, takes on actually how the video game industry actively discourages practices that make things like both preservation practices, but also sort of practices that look back on history in like really useful ways. And I think, you know, a lot of gamers will be really familiar with this idea because we always talk about like, well, like, you know, oh, I went back and played this game from like 5 years ago and the graphics were terrible, right? Like, because like ultimately, you know, often, you know, each new model of console or each new, your new computer can run all of, you know, the water textures are so amazing. But at the same time, that kind of idea of like always going for the next big thing, always sort of looking towards the future means that game companies and to some extent gamers sometimes don't put in the effort to preserve or even to reflect upon sort of where the industry has come from, exactly like what you were saying. And I think what James Newman describes in the book is, and this is something I've actually experienced when I've been talking to folks, is that even if the people who wanted to run these game servers for matchmaking that have been shut down or the preservationists want to go to the game companies and get permission, which is what you would effectively have to do under DMCA 1201, getting like a letter signed from their general counsel saying, hey, we're not going to sue you, is probably, you know, the first step if you're a library and you're really concerned about your university's endowment or like legal pressure. the game companies actually often are not in a position to give that go ahead because the intellectual property rights to these games are fragmented over so many different owners, so many different potential concerns. And actually, I think there's been some really interesting work recently about people who've talked about how hard it is to just, even if they want to like remaster and re-release the game, and they're the original developer, getting the rights to do that because legal departments don't want to sign off on things they're sort of not certain about. So if the rights are sort of in question, if there's any reason they think they can't find the paper trail, or if there's any reason they think they won't be able to give the rights over, they just won't do it. And that's, you know, makes total sense from a corporate point of view, like exactly like what you were saying. But what that means is that consumers who, you know, want to play these older games, or archivists who want to just save a copy so that someone someday can play these older games, are kind of out of luck.
Yeah. And again, another great points, Kendra. You're killing me because I'm trying to keep up. I'm trying to keep on to these points. You keep coming with so many good discussions for me to talk about. And regarding the rights that and getting those rights to redistribute or digitize older games to our digital medium, that is a huge point. And it's something that I talked with GOG.com about a few years ago, who, for those of you who don't know, GOG is a digital store that specializes in redistributing classic video games. I'm talking pre-2000, Windows 98, stuff like that, those games. And they talked about just some of the major headaches, not just from a software point of view, trying to get these old games to work, but as you said, Kendra, getting the IP rights to recreate these games and redistribute them for modern audiences. As you said, a lot of the IP holders, who knows where they are these days? It could be split between multiple people, multiple companies. It may not even be with a video game anymore if another corporate office or another corporate foundation bought the rights when the original company folded. And again, it's such a very much of a quagmire in some cases of trying to get who owns what. And of course, if you mess up in any part of this, you're opening yourself up to be sued for copyright infringement. And most stores or hell, no one wants that to happen to them.
Yeah. I mean, and one of the really interesting things, I think, also is that sometimes they're sort of in this kind of reorganization of rights, or, you know, a game studio gets bought by a larger company or by another game studio. Like, often the products that get dropped are the ones that sort of appeal to like relatively specific audiences. One of the folks who actually filed some testimony in our petition is an anonymous developer who really loved this game, these two games called Technica 2 and 3. And they're arcade rhythm games. I actually got the opportunity to play Technica 3 back in December, and I've never played anything like it. He was totally right that I like had not seen anything like it. So he, after the company, one developer sort of bought the developer that produced Technica 3, they shut down the servers that were basically running all of these arcade machines. So all of these arcades basically had these like, you know, dead boxes, you know, dead cabinets that weren't even, you know, you couldn't even like log in to play single player because it was reliant on this sort of central authentication system. So this guy, you know, I think he described his hobbies as like arcade video game security, which like makes my hobbies look like relatively nonspecific by comparison. But he actually created, you know, reverse engineered the protocol between the authentication server, set up his own authentication server, and the Technica 3 machine I played was running on his server. You couldn't tell. I literally just walked up in an arcade and was like, wait, that's Technica 3. I've talked to the person who did that. And, you know, you couldn't tell that it wasn't running the original, but he basically saved these machines because the game company, you know, it got bought. They don't care. They're sort of, they're not really that concerned. And they just like, his dedication to the franchise and this particular set of games where the mechanics are not like any other rhythm game was basically what saved this for all of these arcades. And, you know, what really breaks my heart a little bit is this is the kind of behavior that video game companies should be encouraging. Like, this is the kind of behavior that they should love, right? This is like, can you imagine like the consumer that is so dedicated to your product that they are willing to like spend, I think it took one of the folks who worked on Metal Gear Online described it taking them 9 months, multiple people, 9 months to reverse engineer the protocol. They spent 9 months on this game that you don't even care enough to keep running.
But
you know,
they
that's
do.
Exactly. So it's really sad that the legal regime is getting in the way of people, playing the games they lawfully own and like kind of saving the stuff for the future.
Yeah. And bringing this also more into the game designer gameplay part of this debate, we mentioned, of course, the multiplayer side of games, so many examples to keep track of. But as you just said with Tenica 3, there's also just simply the functionality of the game that gets called into question when you have server authentication. I remember trying to play EA's Battle for Middle-earth 2, and they had this great sort of like Risk campaign style mode that you could play with friends. But when the servers went down, not only did you lose the traditional one versus one play, but you lost this entire mode that someone designed and implemented into the game. And there's also a lot of examples with sports games, stuff like the if you try to like a fantasy football league with your friends, if there's no servers to connect to, oh, guess what? That functionality is gone. And what's doing, it's limiting really the appeal or the functionality of these games as time goes on through no fault of the consumer.
Exactly. And I think also one of the things that the Entertainment Software Association suggested in their reply to our petition is that online multiplayer just isn't viewed as core functionality by players. And
Oof.
as someone who plays a lot of video
Oof.
games, I kind of boggled my mind because I think especially now that so many games are kind of selling even the single player campaign on like, oh, you can also do this kind of stuff in multiplayer, and like. And if you think about the sort of, I guess it's not really recent anymore, but this whole debacle regarding SimCity, and the sort of server side processing of
Authentication, yeah.
data. Yeah, exactly. The game industry has been actively telling players for years that they need to move towards online multiplayer, towards server authentication, toward, like, that this is kind of where the future is. And I think the saying that this stuff isn't core to the gameplay experience, just exactly as you've sort of described with the Battle for Middle-earth example, like, what if that's why you bought the game,
Yeah.
right? Like to play online with your friends, to have that mode. I think there are many games where I think the multiplayer is actually like the primary selling
Oh,
point.
yeah.
People usually aren't playing Call of Duty for the campaign, or I don't want to, no aspersions on Call of Duty players, but it. So I think it's really striking to see how, the games industry has changed in this particular way. And what this means, I think, about the future is that we need to start paying more attention to how these servers are kept up, because otherwise you just won't be able to play any of the games produced after, what, 2010, right?
Yeah, definitely. And when you just said that they said that multiplayer is not looked at as a core function, I just got a stab in my heart, and so did my seven friends who we've spent like 800 hours playing Left 4 Dead on. I'm sure we all just got a horrible pain in our chest with that statement.
Right, and this is not, our petition doesn't even cover MMOs, right?
Yeah.
So we sort of carved off MMOs as something that where there's really some substantial differences in how the game functionality works. But we're just talking about matchmaking servers or servers that sort of
Yeah.
allow you to play with other people. So yeah, exactly. I think it's hard for me to understand a viewpoint of the games industry that says online multiplayer is just not core, because so much of what people do play games with for and with other people is the experience of playing online with your friends or beating your enemies, whatever it is. That's really important to a lot of players.
Yeah. And a major example that actually right now that me and my friends are actually going through is with the latest Mortal Kombat game for the PC, which has ran into a lot of problems with just some very bad porting issues. There's network connectivity problems, the net code's not right. And what that means is that for people who are looking at a fighting game, which is up there with first-person shooters as a multiplayer-focused game, if the online play doesn't work, the game you pretty much are getting maybe half or quarter of the experience because so much of this game depends on online functionality. And that's not even getting to the whole issue when we throw like competitive games into the mix. And people who do stuff like the EVO tournaments and MLG who rely on these games in order to essentially make a living or a professional career off of.
Yeah, exactly. Tell like League of Legends or any of the MOBA folks that online
Oh.
multiplayer isn't important, right? And I think, games, like the games reviews, like, you know, I was, as we were sort of responding to this, I was trying to think about how do I explain how important this is, right? Like, you know, I don't just take my word for it. And you know, other than appealing to the mass of people who play games who are like, wait, what? And I think something that struck me is how much reviews now take into account server status, you know, multiplayer experience. Like, review sites have really started to look into this as something that, like, they know it's important to players, right? If, you know, if the servers are down the first like 2 weeks after launch, or it's like buggy and unplayable, like that's like a do not buy. And I think that really speaks to how important this is.
Definitely. And there's so many more talks to talk about, but I know your time is limited. So before we talk more about the preservation side, this will actually lead into that discussion. I want to go back to what you said a few minutes ago, Kendra, regarding the fact that both video game developers and consumers in general aren't really pushing for game preservation. And that's part of this whole debate, not just with the online side, but with game preservation and redistributing in general. And this is a problem that I've talked about while on the podcast, I'm sorry, on the website. And as you said, Kendra, the video game industry is a very technological focused industry. It's all about the latest thing, the next new piece of hardware. PC gaming in general, I mean, there's that whole joke about the second you buy your computer, it's already obsolete. Someone's already released a brand new part. So there's always that arms race to get the biggest, most expensive, fastest, whatever piece of hardware. And when people look at hardware in that sense, it immediately devalues. I mean, I remember, of course, I get to show my age. I remember when 4 bits of RAM or 4 megabits of RAM was top of the line, state of the art. I have a 6 gig machine now. There's probably people with 12 or 15 gigs. And what happens to that old technology is that it's useless. Why would you want to hold on to a video card from 1996? There's just no value in there anymore. And taking this to the video game side of things, a lot of consumers just really either they're not educated or they just don't care about preserving these older games. You brought up an example a few minutes ago regarding, you know, I played a game from 10 years ago, the graphics are shit, why should I play this game anymore? But a lot of people view video games as a product, and this brings in the whole argument of, you know, are games art? Art versus products, and that's an hour and a half topic right there. But a lot of people just don't view video games as any more than a very quick commodity. You play it, then you either sell it, throw it out, or you put it in the closet, and who the hell cares if in 10 years are you really going to want to go back and play that? But for people like me, and I assume as well as you, we want to be able to experience these old games. I mean, speaking with GOG, their whole mantra is that these games aren't being made anymore from a design point of view, and you really can't find these experiences anymore. Yes, the graphics aren't going to be as good. Yes, the UI is going to be a little muddy, but it's still an amazing game. I mean, from our point of view, I talk about XCOM, Star Control 2, the original Marios and Zeldas, even to this day, because they still hold up as great examples of design that, if the machines don't work, which we'll talk about briefly next, guess what? You can't play those games anymore.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, the sort of not getting too far into the video games, are they art? I'll just go get, say yes and move on. But I do think, you know, the discussion about how they're viewed as products, like no one would say, you know, oh, we have Picasso, we don't need Monet anymore, right? Like just discard the last 50 years of art. But I do think you're right that, you know, folks see often see because I think it actually has a lot to do with graphics, right? Because I think graphics have sort of evolved, and you can't see my air quotes, but I'm air quoting. Graphics have evolved over the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and gameplay design has changed, but and those are two different things. And I think people sort of often conflate sort of the fact that, you know, there are some things that I think gameplay wise are improvements, right? You know, better accessibility, sometimes more options, like better onboarding for tutorials, that kind of thing, like A plus. But at the same time, it's exactly what you were saying, that the games that got made 10 years ago may not get made now. And if you want to play a game with those design elements and that style, you're going to have to go back. And that understanding that not as like a downside, like, oh, they won't make games like this anymore. but as something that's sort of natural in any field where there's like artistic expression, but also kind of a consumer element, you know, is a really important part of understanding why games preservation hasn't necessarily taken the off the way preservation often does in other fields.
Yeah. And that definitely takes us into talking more about some of the issues with game preservation. Now, I don't know if you had a chance to look into game preservation options on your end, Kendra, but I do want to touch briefly on this, and if you have anything to add, feel free to comment. From my point of view as a game player and someone who examines the industry, one of the issues with preserving video games is that there are really only a few quote-unquote legal options available. One is obviously you own the original hardware. So you have your Atari 2600 or your NES system in the closet somewhere. The other option is really someone is emulating it, whether it's a software emulator like you get on your computer or a hardware emulation that we see like with the PlayStation 2 to PlayStation 1, Wii to GameCube, stuff like that. Now, for a lot of people, they see that as, you know, that's perfect. That's all we need. But there are major problems with that. From the original hardware point of view, as we've talked about this cast, it's becoming harder and harder to find the stuff and to keep it working just through straight hardware. If all the Nintendo controllers in the world break, guess what? You can't play more Nintendo games anymore unless someone actually goes and retrofits or recreates that somewhere else. But then obviously that could be viewed as hacking and be illegal. The other issue, when you look at it from software and hardware emulation, from a hardware point of view, it takes a lot of time and work to create hardware that is backwards compatible. It's one thing that a lot of people talk about with Nintendo, and how one of the reasons why the Wii U, etc., aren't as cutting edge and aren't close to the PS4 or Xbox One in terms of technological power is because they're spending that time and the hardware to make sure that it can retrofit and run those older games. And then lastly, from a software point of view, I read a piece a few weeks ago where in order to get something that's playable, and as you talked about earlier, Kendra, playability is a big deal here. There's a big difference between a software emulator that poorly runs a game versus one that runs it, you know, perfectly. It's like you can't even tell this wasn't on that you're not playing a Super Nintendo. And the hardware requirements and just the technological requirements just multiply dramatically as you're trying to get closer to perfection. And from what we've looked at, there's literally no hardware that could possibly like emulate like a PlayStation or a Nintendo 64 perfectly these days, because the technology just simply doesn't exist. So after that little explanation, did I miss anything, Kendra, or do you have anything you'd like to add?
The only other really interesting thing that I encountered when doing the research for this, which actually is not something that made it into the petition because it's kind of an aside, is there's actually a really amazing, really interesting debate about what emulation means and what does it mean to make playable games. And I don't necessarily want to get too far into the weeds here, but one of the really interesting issues, which your listeners may be familiar with, is that, you know, to what extent do you accommodate the glitches or the original things that were part of the game but may not have been intended or were a product of the way that the hardware ran? So there have been folks who actually argued, and it was really interesting to think about it in this context, that you know some of the original game systems, you should be running them on a CRT, because if you run them on a flat screen, they're just going to look different than they looked the first time. And many people, I'm sure that sounds utterly asinine, right? Like, oh my God, what? But it does raise these really interesting questions around what emulation means and what saving these games means. And I think one of the things that I found while doing the legal research is that that should be a discussion that everyone's really having in the open, that companies are having with players, are having with scholars, are having with archivists, that everyone is getting together and trying to figure out, and we don't have to come to a consensus, right? But like, what does this mean? But instead, because of the legal chilling effects of not just the DMCA, but, you know, other legal regimes, sometimes, you know, EULAs in terms of service, prohibiting particular behaviors, this isn't a conversation that people can really necessarily have in public the way that maybe we should be. Because often, you know, it's folks who the folks who are saving these games are not doing so through traditional archival or institutional mechanisms because institutions can't afford to take on the legal risk involved in saving the game, and saving the game, you know, pun sort of not really intended there. And I think what's really powerful to me about this issue is that, you know, we as like as a lawyer, I want to enable that conversation to happen, and I want to like get out of the way basically of people who are really trying to make sure. Like the Internet Archive, the folks, Jason Scott at the Internet Archive has been doing amazing work on creating playable browser versions of games, you know, and I think he's sort of doesn't deal a lot with the legal issues. And the Internet Archive is willing to take on more legal risk than most archival and institutions, but they shouldn't have to, right? So that's kind of the only thing I would add is that, like, please, like, let us get the law out of the way.
Now, before we move on to our next topic, one last question I have for you, Kendra, is I just want to get your thoughts on one of the, I guess, the devil's advocates that I hear when we talk about these preservation issues, is that many people feel that we should just leave it in the hands of the game developers or the game companies. Like, it's their software, it's their hardware. Why should we have to worry about it? Let's just let them decide what we preserve, what we shouldn't preserve. And a lot of people point to Nintendo in that example because they have the whole virtual console set where you can play NES, Game Boy, Genesis, and whatnot games on that console. So, my question for you, Kendra, is what do you think of that opinion that we should just leave it in their hands?
So I have two thoughts. One is there's this concept from library sciences called LOCKS, which is an acronym that stands for lots of copies keep stuff safe. And so when you're thinking about archiving, you should never ever say, "Well, we'll just have that one person over there handle it." That is never a good solution, because you know there's a lot of the potential for failure if there's only one party responsible is incredible. But to keep us at even moving away from that idea of like this is just not an optimal solution, is that I think part of the thing is that you know there may be certain companies that are really great at running art that at saving versions, at doing like doing the archival and preservation work. First of all, they're still companies, and their interest is not always necessarily totally aligned with that of the public or the gaming public. And second is that, you know, it's all very well and good for Nintendo, but there are a ton of other developers and game developers from the same time period who, if it wasn't for players and archivists picking up their works and saving them, we wouldn't know they exist, right? Or we wouldn't have access to them. So relying on sort of companies to is bad for a couple of reasons. One is it creates a single point of failure. The second is that that their interests may not align with the public in the long term. And the third is that, you know, as we talked about earlier, the games industry in many ways is set up in with short-term views. And that, you know, relying on that means that we may not have the games in the future. And I'd rather, you know, be like, oh, you know, we didn't need all those archivists who were saving copies. Like, but thank God they did it anyway, rather than sort of finding out that we're missing 5, 10, 20 years of gaming history.
All right. So far, this has been a very fascinating cast, Kendra. It's great to talk to someone about these issues, especially someone who is passionate about it and has a lot deeper insight into it with the research that you've done. So, before we move on to our final topic, I know you wanted to share with us, and especially with our audience who may not know about this, is some of the challenges of filing this exemption. Because again, whenever we talk about the legal or the business side when it comes to the video game industry, a lot of that stuff is done behind closed doors, and most people are never made aware of those proceedings. So I'm sure that my audience will definitely find that interesting. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Kendra, and go ahead.
Sure. So one of the really interesting things about the DMCA 1201 exemption process is that the DMCA, the section of the DMCA covers sort of a variety of activities, as we sort of talked about previously in the podcast, you know, John Deere tractors, pacemakers, and video games. What do they have in common? The DMCA 1201. These exemptions, even if the Copyright Office grants it, will only actually last for 3 years. So this is part of a kind of what I would consider personally a pretty flawed way of thinking about this law, because it requires an enormous amount of time and energy by public interest organizations, by interested citizens, by, you know, lawyers, to file these proceedings. And they only last 3 years, and then you have to do it again, basically, show that there's still a need for the next 3 years for this exemption. So, you know, I'm really hopeful that the Copyright Office will see the value in what we're suggesting and sort of allow us to allow video gamers and archivists to have a little more legal breathing room. But this is something, you know, this is a sort of broader political issue about how the 1201 functions. And I think it does really, the burden of proof is on us to show that we need the exemption every 3 years. And that's really not ideal from the perspective of making sure that folks can continue to play the games that they lawfully purchased. You know, they shouldn't have to rely on, you know, me or the EFF working every 3 years. They should be able to show it once and then be able to keep playing.
And that's a really good point, Kendra. That reminds me of actually when I spoke with Farsight Studios, who do the pinball arcade, where they basically digitize physical arcade machines and they put it to the PC, the mobile phones, and basically tries to create a perfect emulation of those physical machines. He talked about similarly about getting and reacquiring the rights to continue producing and selling these digital copies. And my memory, I'm drawing a blank on this, but I think he said that when they required the rights to redistribute a pinball arcade, they get it for, I think, 3 to 5 years. It could be 3 years, it could be 5 years. And then after that time, they have to, as you said, with the DMCA exemption, they would have to reapply for that. Now, if they don't get it, then they can't sell that specific that specific pinball level anymore. But in this case, if you guys, you know, if you get for 3 years and another 3 years, and then after that it stops, then what happens? Then we're back to square one again, almost.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, that, I think, part of what the problem with this is, it creates this environment of legal risk. It's less, you know, many gamers who run these servers feel confident that the companies won't sue them, and that's great. Or they, you know, they've gotten through the grapevine that maybe the company's okay with them doing it, and, you know, like, Godspeed, that's awesome. But, you know, people shouldn't have to take on incredible amounts of legal risk in order to do this thing that is, like, fundamentally lawful and in the best interests of the video game companies.
Definitely. All right. With that, I know we're moving very much along here. We've touched on a lot of great topics, but we have one final point to discuss for this podcast, and that is the Entertainment Software Association's response to the EFF's exemption. By the time this podcast goes up, there should be some pretty big news coming from the EFF, right? You guys are going, or the EFF's going to be releasing their statement, right?
That's correct.
Yep. So make sure to look for that. I'll be sure to include a link to that in the podcast notes when this goes up. So the ESA, as we said, after the EFF and yourself filed the exemption claim about the DMCA, the ESA responded. And I don't have an exact quote from them. The one that we all hear, the one that was mentioned a lot on various sites, including Gamasutra, is that they felt that because this is considered hacking, that it's illegal and that is a complete, you know, dead stop, no, you shouldn't do it. And another part of it was they felt that pretty much glamorizing or condoning this would basically say that it's all right to pirate games, it's all right to hack games. And they felt that this was, you know, going to be a bad for the children or bad for people wanting, it's basically giving them an excuse to pirate in a sense. Now, I could go on like a 20-30 minute rant about that statement, but what do you think about that, Kendra? Or what was running through your head when you saw their response?
So I think that often the sort of organizations that represent creators argue that there are going to be market harms for these kinds of lawful uses. That you see this sort of same theme, not necessarily, in some cases, legitimately, explicitly of piracy, run through a lot of the responses from people like the MPAA or the RIAA, which represent the video, the movie folks, and then the music folks, sort of respectively. And I think part of what it, this concern, so first of all, I think the concern about piracy is somewhat misplaced because a lot of the games, you know, as I think your listeners will probably know, and most gamers probably know, you know, digital rights management schemes update very regularly. You know, you're not, companies aren't using the same DRM that they were using 2 or 5 or 10 years ago. So there, you know, to the extent that there are concerns about sort of creating more informational resources about circumventing DRM, the DRM schemes that would be implicated by this request are often ones that are out of date anyway. Additionally, I think this fear of piracy, you know, I understand that that's the ESA's job to sort of represent creators in this particular instance, but I think, you know, I obviously think they're sort of on the wrong side of history, because I think what's going on here is that the, you know, I think very few, unfortunately, the fact is that pirates are going to pirate, right? Folks who are willing to steal games will find ways to do it. I don't think our exemption will assist them in finding methods to pirate games. I think that, and I think that to say that that will happen is really giving short shrift to the many, many game enthusiasts who care deeply about playing lawful games and who care deeply about running these servers. One of the things I found in my research is actually most of the communities that run these servers explicitly prohibit talk of like piracy and explicitly do not like when people use pirated games to run on their servers, right? They have like sort of actively come out against this because you know what they want? They would really love if the companies could A, continue to run the servers and B, that they produce more games, right? You know, the folks who really love these games enough to play these games and continue playing them when the sort of newer, better version is released, and again, air quotes on the newer, better, are the people who, you know, they didn't buy one copy, maybe they bought four, right? So I think that the piracy concern, although I can understand perhaps why the ESA sort of raises it as an objection, really doesn't address the sort of legitimate desires of players to continue playing the games they lawfully own, and doesn't really, it's just like, is not a compelling enough or like real or proximate enough harm to offset the real benefits to players, to even creators whose games will now be archived and kept alive where they wouldn't before, to justify withholding the exemption. And I think, you know, we, you know, there's other things that the ESA argues in their petition, including that sort of they have that, you know, we have folks, testimony from folks who actively work on games preservation, who represent museums, who represent the Internet Archive, who represent scholars. And they all believe really strongly that this is really important and this issue is really important. And I think that, you know, the ESA got a lot of backlash when they sort of came out against this. And I think it's deserved because I think it doesn't represent the best interest of gamers or of developers.
Yep, and I agree with you on that, Kendra. The point I think you brought up that is one that I harp on every time we talk about piracy is obviously people are going to pirate games. There are always going to be that section of the audience who they will pirate your game. It doesn't matter what the price is. It doesn't matter what the quality is. I've known people like that in the past who it doesn't matter if the game is $100 or $1. If there is the pirated option available, they're going to pirate it. And there's nothing what you would say or what the publisher or developer would say that's going to convince them otherwise. And for that group of people, we can't really factor them in a discussion of game preservation because they're just completely out of it. And as you said, Kendra, what this exemption is trying to do is simply to preserve these games and allow people to continue using them way beyond the developer or the publisher's interaction. And I think this also goes back to what we talked about with the attitude of the general video game consumer, is that, as we said, they look at the latest, the new, the now, whatever. They're not thinking 10, 15, or even, hell, they're not even thinking like 5 years in the future when either the console has been, it's no longer production, the games are becoming harder to find. Or, of course, the whole point of this podcast and the exemption, what happens when those servers get taken down in 2 to 3 years after the game is done being profitable? What happens to those games? And it's a conversation that more people really need to start having because we're already at that point where it's very hard to find stuff that's 1, 2 generations old. what's going to happen when we get to third and fourth and so on generation games that no longer exist, at least in the physical space?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, I think a lot of gamers are actually beginning to understand that this issue is going to be important. And I've been really heartened to see the response to by people to the petition and to this process being like, wow, you know, I'm glad someone is sort of working on that. It's kind of what people say to me sometimes. And honestly, you know, it's an honor to be working on it. But so it's been really powerful to see how, you know, even though often I think it's not in the forefront of the minds of game developers, I think game like enthusiasts and, you know, preservationists and those two groups obviously overlap substantially often, are really have been paying attention to this issue and do really think it's important. And that's, you know, that's my sort of the thing that gives me hope about the future about of this is that there are people who really care deeply about this issue and who want to make sure that, you know, the games that they played when they're teenagers are available to their kids. And as the, you know, we made the joke on the blog post, maybe not the Grand Theft Auto, but, you know, some of those other games, right? You don't want your 13-year-old playing that. But I think it is, you know, this movement towards really understanding that, you know, games shape our culture and games shape us, and that we need to make sure that that is something we can sort of come back to when we want to, rather than sort of letting it die.
Yeah. And I think as one of my final points for this podcast, one area that I think is really helping that movement or gain that understanding of the quality and the importance of video games has really been the indie market and how a lot of developers there are striving to make very unique, very amazing pieces of video games, which we can really classify as art. Games like Dear Esther, Gone Home, and so many more games that you can see that passion and design. And as we've said over the course of this entire podcast, a lot of the games that we're talking about, they're not getting made anymore. Whether it's from a financial point of view, from a design point of view, it doesn't matter. They're just simply not going to be around. You can't find, you know, 10 sequels of this game. Like, I would love to play 5 more XCOM games, but we're not seeing too many of those these days.
It's true.
And I think, as we said, we're starting to have that conversation more because we're seeing a lot of games that I would say the general market feel like they feel like they deserve, that they should be remembered. Stuff like Journey for the PS3 and the games that I just mentioned. These are games that were really one-and-done things. You can't really get that same experience with, you know, 27 different Gone Homes. It just won't be the same as that first time you played it. And it's great, I think, for you, Kendra, and for this whole argument that people are saying, you know, hey, we want to see this happen. We want to support you. Because that is a huge cry from 5-10 years ago when people are saying, you know, who the hell cares? Why do I even want to play my old Super Nintendo games? Or why do I want to play games on Windows, whatever the Windows version is, Windows 98, etc.? You know, I want to play what's now. And it's great that we're finally having that discussion. People are saying, you know, this is an amazing game. I want to make sure that I can play this in 5-10 years ago. I mean, it would be amazing to talk even farther than that, to say, you know, could we hold on to these games for 30, 40 years? But of course, that is something that's way too early for either of us or for anyone to really talk about right now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, 30 or 40 years in the future is, you know, a long time away, but I'm hopeful. I'd like to hope that the games that I played when I was a teenager are things that, you know, I can pick up much later and be like, really understand how those experiences shaped me.
Well said, Kendra. And this has been a fantastic cast. As I said at the start, this is a topic that I'm very passionate about. It's obviously one that you and the rest of the EFF are passionate about as well. And it's a discussion that I think, to sum up this whole podcast, is one that we really need to be having, not just in the open, but more readily. We need a lot more people to be talking about this, because this is not just our products, but it is our culture and the art form of the game industry. So, again, I would love to sit here and chat with you for the next few hours about this, but I know you're very busy, and we do have the EFF statement regarding the ESA coming up, or it should be up by the time this podcast is posted. So, to wrap things up for tonight, Kendra, do you have any final thoughts on this topic that you would like to say?
No, I think we've actually covered most of my thoughts on this topic. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a pleasure meeting you, Kendra, and I would definitely love to have you back on. I know you're obviously busy at law school. I know this is probably also taking up a lot of your time. But yeah, I will definitely be following up with you later on, and it will be great to have you back.
Thanks so much.
All right. So with all that said, we're going to wrap things up for this cast, but definitely this is a discussion that we need to come back to, not just from enthusiasts or consumers, but as an industry in the whole. And I would definitely love to have more of this talk with future podcasts and future topics. For right now, though, we're going to end things for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a guest on the podcast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find that information under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our Patreon campaign for some much-needed monthly funding to keep Game Wisdom going and growing, you can find that information on the Patreon banner on the front page. And last but not least, if you'd like to tune into my daily Let's Plays and live streams of games, you can find me on Twitch under my handle of GW Bicer, and all the recordings will go up on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. Again, Kendra, I'd just like to thank you so much for taking the time being on the cast tonight. This was a great cast, and I hope we can do this again real soon.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Yep. And with that said, thanks for listening in for this great topic. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.